Perfect. Okay. First of all, personal mechbel achsanya. Thank you so much to the Kariyas once again for hosting Magen Avot event in their home and opening up their home as they do so frequently and so beautifully. We're so grateful. Shalom Aleichem to my esteemed predecessor, Roy Kenzberg. It's so lovely to have you with us. And this is such a lovely event. It's such a nice opportunity for me to publicly thank you for all the support you've given me personally over the last 2 years. We speak regularly. Roy Kenzberg has been an incredible confidant, help, and advisor and supporter. And we hope the Kehillah is growing mechoel achoel in continuing the amazing work that you did over many, many years. So thanks to everyone for organizing this event, Simon and the executive, and it's a really special event, and I think really the aim of this event is really for us to have a conversation, but it shouldn't just be myself and Rabbi Kenzberg, it should be everyone, it should be more of a community conversation, but I'll just set the tone. Parshas Chukas, this week we're going to learn about Moshe Rabbeinu, who hits the rock instead of talking to the rock. We know he's punished severely, he never makes it to Eretz Yisrael. Just to try and imagine what that means, his entire life he never gets to go to Eretz Yisrael, his dream, his vision, he's the leader of Klal Yisrael, and he never makes it in. Whenever I read Parshas Chukas, I think of my grandfather, who was a Polish Yid who came to this country and was able to escape the war and lived a successful life here in the UK, but he never made it to Eretz Yisrael. In fact, when I was 9 years old, we had booked a family holiday to finally take my Zayda to Israel. We were all going, Hanukkah 1992. It was very exciting. It was his first trip to Israel. Unfortunately, he passed away 2 months before the trip. And whenever I stand at the Kotel, I think of him. And I think to myself that we must never ever take Eretz Yisrael for granted. We must always appreciate it. We must realize what a blessing it is, what an absolute privilege it is. And, you know, just now I took Emmanuel College students to America instead of Eretz Yisrael. And I said to them on the trip, you guys are not where you're supposed to be. This is plan B. This is not where the Jewish people are supposed to be. This is definitely not plan A. And I think for all of us here, for all of us here sitting in Chutz La'aretz, even though we are blessed with a vibrant Jewish life in London, we're blessed with a vibrant community in Magen Avot, we all know Libi B'Mizrach. We're all supposed to be in Eretz Yisrael. That's what it's all about. That's where our ultimate destination is. So I think having Roy Kenzberg here to really remind us of the importance and the sanctity and the privilege of Eretz Yisrael is something that is so important, especially right now. It's something we all need a reminder of. Mefarshim spent great deals talking about what was actually the crime of Moshe Rabbeinu. He was judged so, so strictly. What did he do wrong? The Sforno said that he didn't use his power of speech to be Mekadosh Shem Shamayim. He could have used his power of speech. Ever since then, every single rabbi has taken that very seriously, and they've used their power of speech wherever possible to speak and to speak and to speak to make up for that. But we're going to try and keep this not too long tonight, within an hour, but we're going to try and have a bit of a conversation with Roy Kenzberg. I'm going to ask a series of questions, and please feel free to join in the conversation, to help yourselves to refreshments, and to make this as interactive as possible. So I guess my first question for you, Roy Kenzberg, this evening is, tell us a little bit about, before we get to October 7th, first of all, you've been there at Yisrael now, coming up for the best part of 2 years. How's it all going? How's your family? Must have on your new baby boy. Give us a little bit of insight into life making Aliyah, or returning, rather, should I say. And how's that been for you? And share with us a little bit.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you, everybody. It is wonderful to be here, to be back. Thank you, too. Thank you to our Gold Cups, thank you to Simon and to Tony and Baruch for hosting and everybody who was involved in organizing tonight. You said it, Eretz Yisrael is the place to be. You know, that's home. We'll talk a little bit later about October 7th, post-October 7th. I think it's interesting, and I was thinking, in terms of the lead up to tonight, so a couple of years ago when Corona hit, remember that? And I remember in those early days, which were quite traumatic, and everybody's trying not to think about them, but the chief rabbi made a comment. He said, you know, in the same way that there was a post-war era and a pre-war era, he said, in our days, you know, we have Corona, we're going to look back on this as pre-Corona days, post-Corona days. I think that's true as well. But definitely more than that, you know, we now look at our lives pre-October 7th, post-October 7th. That's the way it's going to be forever. So much change in our lives personally, in our lives nationally, the way the world is. So there are only two eras here, I think, that we can divide our lives into. Talking about pre-October 7th, so, I mean, it was never a secret that we were going back, that we were going back to Israel. You know, we came here, we were on Shlichut, we had 4 wonderful years in London, 3 wonderful years in Magen Avot, and we went back. When we left, we didn't know where we were going to go. We were sure that we were going back to Israel, we were going back home. At the time, wasn't clear. An opportunity came up at Beit Knesset HaNasi, which is in Rochavia, which is in Jerusalem. Before that, before I knew about the job and about the position, people asked me, where are you going to go back? Where are you going to live? I've always loved Yerushalayim. We always lived there before we came to London. I wanted to go there, but it wasn't realistic. We're going to find a community there. We're looking at other places. And then there was just the Siyata Deshmaya. The opportunity fell from, just came out of nowhere. And Baruch Hashem. So we live in Rehavia, central Jerusalem, center of the world. The shul, I have the privilege of working alongside Rabbi Beryl Wein, who I was telling the rabbi before that next week we actually have a special gala dinner in honor of his 90th birthday. Very, very special event. Rabbi Wein is a very, very special person. And the community is great. It's not Magenavot, but it's a really nice place and warm people. And we're doing well. Baruch Hashem, the kids. Sarah's doing well. She sends her regards to everybody. It's very sad she's not here tonight, but she's doing well. The kids are doing well. Kids are speaking Hebrew. We now have to fight with them to speak English. So that's, things are...
Fantastic. And so this is your full-time role. You're involved with other things
so
as well.
So, yes, right? I work so two-thirds officially at the shul in terms of Beit Knesset HaNasih. What's very unique about Beit Knesset HaNasih is that, I'm sure everybody knows, you know, the idea, the concept of community is something which is very strong in Chutz La'aretz. It's one of the things that Israel needs to learn from Chutz La'aretz. Because for most places in Israel, you have a shul, you go, you daven, but you don't have a community as such. We all know how important community is, how much community can give to all of us. Knesset HaNasih is mostly Olim from America, from England, mostly older Olim as well. So people who are used to it and are very much used to this idea of community. And that's something very special. In addition to that, I work in a place called Eretz Chemba. We'll talk about it a little bit later. But that's where I studied before I came to London. And now I'm back there on staff, helping to train rabbis, helping to train shlichim to go out in the future. So those are the two main roles.
Well, amazing. Well, we wish you so much hatzlacha. It sounds fantastic. And I look forward to come and visit. It's our chance to see you in Beit Knesset HaNasih.
The invitation is open to everybody to come and visit. So,
fantastic. Looking forward. Turning our attention now a little bit to October 7th, which I guess was, 274 days ago. It's been at the center of all our thoughts, all our tefillot, all our emotions. I still will remember that moment. I think it was you, Julian, who came over to me during Shacharit and told me there's been a terrible attack in Israel. And none of us really knew in those first few hours what to make of it. Was it another terrorist attack? Was it more serious, less serious? Slowly, as the hours and the next 24 hours unfolded, it became apparent this is something like we've never seen. And we adapted a little bit our Simchat Torah. We still had our celebrations, although we weren't quite sure. Do we dance? Do we not dance? Slow songs, fast songs? We only really understood the full extent Motzei Chag, on Motzei Second Day Chag, when really things were becoming a lot clearer. But I guess we'd be interested to understand what was it like actually living in Israel through this period. If you could talk us through moment by moment your Shmiat Seres Simchat Torah and what that was like for you, we'd like to know.
Sure. So, as I say, the world, I think, and our lives forever will be divided into pre-October 7th and post-October 7th. And this is a day, and these are moments which are seared into all of our consciousness. Remember, in Israel, Shemini Atzeret Simchat Torah is on the same day. So, and it's actually funny. I can remember, the night before was Simchat Torah. Here, you only had Simchat Torah the next day. But the night before Simchat Torah, our shul is on the border of Rehavia and Shari Chesed. We walked out of shul after the Hakafot, and we're walking through the streets are packed, and everybody's dancing from one place to another, and having kiddush in the middle of the street, and kugel and cholent and whatever, and dancing with the Sivrei Torah, and the streets were packed. Yet none of us had any idea what was coming. That's why you think about it, and it's this parallel universe. And I remember, so Simchat Torah morning, I came to shul, I think 8 a.m. or something, and there were places where people knew what was going on because soldiers have been called up, and Miluim, people had their phones on. Our community is mostly an older community. I think we have one person in our community who's still doing active Miluim service. The rest have got grandkids and great-grandkids who are in that category. And I walked into shul. It was about 8 a.m. And somebody, as soon as I walked in, somebody approached me. I don't know how he found out, but I'll never forget. He walked over to me and said, Rabbi, we're at war. I said, what are you talking about? He said, there's been rock. He said, I turned on the radio. I'm thinking, what possibly happened that justified you turning on the radio on Chag? He says, there's been rockets. There's been hundreds of rockets. They fired at the south. They've infiltrated some of the Yishuvim. At this time, again, there was so much chaos. Nobody really knew what was going on. He says, we're at war. He says, I suggest to you that we cancel Hakafot. We don't do that. We just dive in very quickly and we send everybody home. And we have rockets from time to time. That's not unusual. That's something everybody knows and everybody's, we talk about whether we should have let it get to that and whatever. Only in Israel, you have this word, they call it tiftufin. Tiftofim, which means drops of rain. In Israel, we have drops of, you know, rockets and explosions. I thought, okay, you know, if there's a chance, because occasionally you get the rockets in Yerushalayim as well. If there's a chance something should happen, we should be vigilant, we should tell people where to go, etc. But to cancel shul, there's no, you know, there's no need for that. So the president walked in, of the shul, not of the country. The president walks in, and we had a quick discussion. We said, okay, let's make an announcement, let's tell people, if there's a siren, everybody goes to the stairwell, those who can get to the shelter. Again, most of our members were not able to get to the shelter in time. We have stairs, we, you know, up on the third floor, we have people in wheelchairs, that's not... But, you know, there was no reason, there was no thought even to cancel. So we begin davening, we made the announcement, we began davening, and it was actually quite something. It was as the Kohanim were about to get up to say Birkat Kohanim, we had the first, before that, the Chazan came over to me, he said, what if there's a siren during Shemona Esrei? What am I meant to do? I said, you stop and we go to the back. There's no question, it's Sfek B'Koach Nefesh. So we were doing the repetition of the Amidah, and we got to Birkat Kohanim. And as the Kohanim, you know, the Bracha of Shalom, one of the Kohanim said to me afterwards, as if Hashem was saying on that day, we don't have the right to Birkat Kohanim today, we don't have the Bracha of Shalom. And we all went to the back, we went to the stairwell, you know, those who could. And there was something unique, because there was a siren. The rules are, of course in Israel nobody follows the rules, but the rules are meant to be that when you hear the siren, you're meant to wait in the shelter for 10 minutes, because pieces of shrapnel can come down, so nobody waits for 10 minutes. But within those 10 minutes, there was another siren, and another siren, and we could tell immediately, this was something on a different scale, this was not what we were used to. So we went back in, we finished up davening, and now, at this point, you know, we started questioning, what should we do? So then we got to Halal, and the Chazan asked me, should we sing? I said, let's just daven as quickly as we can. It was the quickest Halal ever, and it's actually that same Chazan who was davening then, was davening now on Shabbat, which was Rosh Chodesh, and I'll never forget it, when he got to the Ana Hashem Moshiana, we didn't sing anything. We got through as quickly as we could, but Ana Hashem Moshiana, with more Kavana than ever, and every time we get to Halal and we say those words again, Ana Hashem Moshiana, just... I think back to that day. And as he finished Halal, was the second siren. I've skipped one. The first one was during Pesukei Dezimra. And then it was the second one was during Birkat Kohanim. And at that point we said, okay, we won't give everybody an aliyah, we'll just do quicker kafah, we'll just take Sefer Torah, we'll go around. And then there was the third one. And at this point, we started to think, okay, this is something unusual. This is not the way it normally is. Because we had a lot of elderly people in our shul, because we have a lot of exposure to glass windows and things, we said we can't take the responsibility, we have to send everybody home. So we cancelled shul. I can tell you that in Knesset Tennessee during Corona, shul was never cancelled. Rabbi Wein was very insistent, I was here at the time, Rabbi Wein was very insistent, if we close, obviously within the legal, you know, what was allowed, it was very interesting, if we close, you know, people aren't going to come back. And it's true, we have a lot of elderly members of our community who have not come back since Corona. But we said, we don't know what's going on. We heard a little bit because a number of people have got, you know, non-Jewish helpers who are with them on all the time. It was actually at one point I turned around in the back corner of the shul, just outside. There were three people crowded around one of the, you know, Filipino workers who had his cell phone out. People were standing in shul on Shabbat watching the news. I mean, nobody, but even then nobody knew what was going on. I asked him, I said, he told me, in this language, he said the Arabs have gone into some of the Yishuvim and they've made a balagan. That was that's the extent of what we knew. So we sent everybody home. We said, better safe than sorry. Some people said, can we just make a minyan? Can we daven Yizkor? Can we daven Musaf? I said, you've got to ask the president. I'm not making that decision. But we made the decision to close. We went home. And throughout the day, there were a number of sirens again. So we're in a building. We don't have a miklat in our building. But we go down into the stairwell. And I remember we had neighbors, again, non-observant neighbors who were, you know, looking at their phones, and they saw and we overheard, they said that 80 people had come to Soroka Hospital. Again, we've had rockets, we've had things. I mean, now we know the numbers, now we're 9 months later. But at the time we had 80 people injured. What possibly happened? You know, that was horrific. That was unfathomable. And throughout the day, you know, we waited until, again, our shul, we couldn't open because we couldn't communicate to people whether we could daven Mincha Maariv. I daven Mincha Maariv across the street from where we live. And I rushed home on Motzei Shabbat. And I walked in and I said to Sarah, I said, how bad is it? Because we'd had rumors the whole day. We didn't know what. And the initial reports that came out on the news said 100 people dead. And it was horrific. You know, that was beyond what we... And then in the days that followed, just day by day, you heard the numbers were going up and up and up and up. And at that time, terrorists were still there. There were firefights going on in Sderot and in Ofakim. And it was just... I think chaos is a word that describes it better than anything else. So that was that was October 7th. And then we woke up October 8th and we realized we had to do something. We couldn't just ignore it. So the situation in Yerushalayim had calmed down enough that it was, we were still, for the first few weeks, months, I don't even remember now, but we had sirens, we had rockets, and all the time, you were walking to shul, you were planning your routes about where you could go on the way in case there was a siren. Actually, the first or the second siren had hit. So Sarah and the kids were at home, and they were walking into shul. As they were walking into shul, the siren came. And so, the kids, they all ran towards the shul, and she still has this image in her head of just the kids just running. And after we found out the extent of the infiltrations of what was going on, it could have happened. It could have happened in Jerusalem as well. In Jerusalem as well, there could have been terrorists out on the street and just. So on the one hand, there is obviously just the horror, the shock, the pain, and the grief at what happened. At the same time, grateful that at least for us personally, in our sort of direct family that and a community that nobody was affected. But so the next day we got together, we sent out an announcement, we said shul will be happening, we opened up the miklat, we made sure that there were those provisions, and we had an Erev Chizuk, the night, I guess what was Motzei Simchat Torah for you, which was a Sunday night. We came to shul, we said some Tehillim, Rabbi Wein spoke, I spoke, and we went on from there.
Wow. So I think we spoke...
You didn't speak about the fear. I mean, surely there was tangible fear in the air. You spoke about physically what you were doing, but you haven't actually told. Surely there was tangible fear. Did you not see people running in the streets and people staying in the homes, not coming out? The streets must have been empty.
So look, in Jerusalem, because we knew this was kind of in the south, and the north opened up very quickly as well. I don't think there was fear in that sense. Nobody thought that. But there was. I mean, for the first few weeks, I tell you, the streets were. You remember what it was like in Corona when you would walk out and there was just this eerie quiet on the street. It was exactly like that because schools were closed, nobody was going to work, and everybody was at home, and everybody was staying, waiting for within arm's length of a shelter. And it was very, very peculiar in that sense. I think there was definitely anxiety in the air. Everybody was nervous because everybody knew somebody who was there, who was fighting, whether it's in the first circle, 1 degree of separation or 2 degrees of separation. Can remember there was so much confusion the first few days. Nobody, people had relatives who were out who were fighting, who was injured and who was killed and who was kidnapped and nobody knew anything. So we had certainly, within our community, we had hundreds of relatives, friends, children, grandchildren who were out there fighting their first night. When, after we spoke, one of the congregants came up to me in tears and he said his cousin's grandson, who was very, 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 very close to, had been there, had been fighting and he was killed. That was the first, unfortunately, there are other members of our community who've lost first degree relatives.
How did you take care of your community? You had talked about that, your community's elderly, how did you take care of them?
Yeah.
Because they must have felt very isolated.
Yeah, so that's true. So the truth, there were, sometimes it's funny, but in an ironic sort of way, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Makdim Refuah L'Makah. And I felt that a lot of the lessons that we had learned from Corona, there were a lot of parallels between that and this period. And we went back, we had Zoom and we had this idea of what happens when everybody's stuck at home by themselves and what do we do? So we reverted back to a lot of those things. We began immediately off that first week. We had a weekly chizuk call, for example. We had on Zoom. We would all meet together. At this time, people weren't comfortable coming out of their homes. And it was calling people up and making sure that people had what they needed. But the truth is that most people were not even thinking about themselves. Which is then most people immediately, even the elderly and the vulnerable and everybody, the first question on everybody's mind was, what can we do to help? How can we jump into action? How can we volunteer? How can we give? What can we do? And it was really more about giving people that outlet and finding those channels where they could participate as well. Obviously, the first stage was ensuring everybody's safety and making sure that everybody had, was where they needed to be and could go where they needed to go in case of alerts and such.
Sure. I guess as a rule as well, challenging shyness coming your way, challenging pastoral situations, and just kind of setting up shop to help and support. And I know you're involved in many chesed organizations that got going as well for your community. You shared with us a little bit about that kind of, I guess, almost positivity through this terrible negative time.
Yeah, so I mean, first of all, I mean, you talk about Shiloh. So the first thing that came up immediately was Shabbat. You know, after that, so we had a whole week because Simchat Torah was on Shabbat. But after that, and again, at that point, there was that fear because people didn't know where this was going to develop. You know, at the beginning was, are there going to be riots within central Israel as well? Are those, you know, from Yudan Shomron, were there going to be terrorist attacks in Jerusalem? We were on high alert. The first thing we did was we looked for a security guard. We installed a new lock at the entrance of the shul. We had somebody, you know, with a weapon at the door at all times because we just couldn't take the risk. People came in with a question, can we walk around with our cell phones on Shabbat? That was the first thing. So obviously, those who are soldiers, those who are in active duty in Miluim, there was no question. You take your phone if you need to get called up, you can answer it. As I said, in our community, you know, people that are 70, 80 years old are generally speaking not being called up to Miluim. Although there are exceptions. I actually heard about yesterday about somebody who's in his 70s who's been on active reserve duty for the last 9 months. Not from our community. Obviously not on the front lines. That's more sort of, you know, guarding behind. But so people came and said, can we walk around with a cell phone on Shabbat? So the question was, you know, for what purpose? Meaning if there's a real need for it, for Pekuach Nefesh, sure. But I discussed this with Rabbi Wan. You know, people, if it's just a case of you want to know what's going on and you want to hear what's going on somewhere far away, so that's not a justification. We did tell people to leave their phones on, or if necessary, you know, the TV and the radio have what they call the Gal Shaket. You know, this quiet, where every time that there's an alert, it's quiet, and every time there's an alert, they tell you. I was against that, though, because then you hear the alert everywhere in the country. I thought it would just raise people's anxiety to hear all Shabbat about the alert in Sderot and the south and Ashkelon, and we needed to know. Because sometimes you don't actually hear the sirens. Sometimes it's faint and you don't hear, so you have the app on your phone, and then you can hear it immediately. So that we told people, you know, keep the phones on in terms of that. We had a couple of people in Shul who had phones, just in case, Chas v'Chalila, there was a need for it, and emergency services needed to be contacted. But most people, it was, you know, it was kind of carry on. And those who needed to stay home, stayed home. So I'll just tell you in terms of one initiative that we were involved in. Rav Rimon, who is, you know, I'm sure everybody here has heard of him. He was in England recently as well. Rav Yosef Tzvi Rimon, he's one of the leading poskim today in the national religious world. And he is an ish asiyah. He's a person of action. He has many, many different organizations, which he's spearheaded. And he created a new organization called Atufim. It's a very, very clever name. Atufim means, on the one hand, it's sort of wrapped, embraced, to give a hug. And it's related to the word Otef Aza, which is, you know, what they call the Gaza envelope communities, those areas near the border. And what they did was essentially they adopted communities, because we've had something here, aside from the war and everything that's going on, we had the evacuation, both in the south and in the north, the evacuation of communities, which we've never had before, in Yerushalayim, around us, you know, in the hotels. Sophia has a friend now in Gan, two, in fact, who are one from the north and I think one from the south, who've been living in hotels in Jerusalem for the last 9 months. You know, you think what it's like to go away to a hotel, we normally think it's fun. Maybe for one night or for two nights, but when you've left your home, these people 9 months ago left their homes, no one knows when they're going back. So it's very, very difficult, it's very traumatic, and there's obviously a lot of support that people need. So Reverend Mon established an organization called Atufim, which basically took certain communities in the south with the aim of helping them to rebuild. And it's a 5-point plan. You know, there are immediate needs which they need, there are immediate security needs, there's education, there's jobs, all sorts of things. So we partnered with him as a community. We raised money for a certain community called Socha, which I'd never heard of. It's actually, the government decided that up to 4 kilometers from the border, communities are entitled to a certain amount of assistance. Up to 7 kilometers from the border is the second level of assistance. And Sochar is 7 kilometers and 123 meters from the border. So they don't get the assistance because they're just outside the line. So we partnered with them. We've donated money. We've gone to visit a few times, and that's one of the initiatives. There are many other things as well. I mean, one of the first things we did, we created a Tehillim list for our shul. So we said, everybody who has grandchildren or relatives that are currently out fighting, send in their names, and we set up a Tehillim group, and we'll daven for them, with them in mind specifically. We had, within minutes, hundreds of names. I don't remember now the exact number, but we have about 3 pages that goes out in the newsletter every week of the names of the soldiers. Obviously, we daven for everybody, and obviously we have everyone in mind. But those are specifically what, you know, for the people in our community that have a personal connection to.
Wow. Gosh. I guess also one of the things that we're interested to understand a little bit is the political situation in Israel, because pre-October 7th, there was huge division, huge tensions and rallies and protests and government and the left and the right and the judicial review, and it kind of all dropped on October 7th. There we saw straight after this real sense of unity, which I think has dissipated a little bit now, 7 to 9 months down the line, but I guess your perception and understanding of what that's been like would be really interesting for us as well.
Okay, thanks. So I'm really glad you asked that question, because I think there's a lot of misconceptions here that need to be cleared up. I think even within Israel, you know, we see the news, we hear the media, there's a certain narrative that is portrayed and a certain picture which is painted, which is not always accurate. And sometimes it's intentionally that way. So let me just say, you know, where we live on a street called Binyamin Metudela, which is right next to a street called Rehov Azza. Rehov Azza is a very famous street because the Prime Minister of Israel lives there, you may know. And so when these protests take place, which started before the war with the judicial reform, and to a certain extent have returned since, they're literally on our doorstep. So the streets are closed, and we see the police, and we see the protesters, and we hear the noise, and everything. So we have a bit of a sense in terms of where it is. You're right. Before October 7th, the country was in a very, very divided place, and there was a lot of concern from all quarters. And you know, I don't think there can be any doubt that is one of the factors that led to this war beginning when it did. Whether you explain that from a rational perspective or from a mystical perspective, however you want to say it, the fact is that when we are divided, we are weakened, and our enemies see it. And it's, you know, these protests which take place every Motzei Shabbat, they're showing that those pictures are on Arab news channels. Always. And our enemies thought that we were divided. They didn't understand that was external, and that deep down, I think maybe we didn't understand that, you know, how united we actually are. Because the moment what happened on the morning of October 7th, all of that disappeared. You know, left and right and religious and secular and Haredi and this and that, it was gone in an instant. We are the Jewish people and that's who we are. And you had, you know, settlers from Otniel and other places, you know, going down to the kibbutzim to fight, and some who tragically lost their lives. That was, you ask anybody, you know, what it was like those early days. I'm sure you felt it here to an extent as well. The sense of unity, the sense of coming together, the sense of, you know, we are one people, we're all in it for one another. Beyachad menatzeach. That's become, you know, the motto in Israel. And that's something which was incredible to see. And I don't think anyone's ever seen it before, you know, to this extent. Every time we've had wars, we've had operations, and there's always this kind of coming together. But this was something different. This was on another level entirely. You had, it's strange to think about, just before Simchat Torah, so Yom Kippur this past year, the big machloket was, you know, there was this question of this public tefillah in Yom Kippur that was meant to take place in Dizengoff Square in Tel Aviv. And the area, there were those who said, how can you have a mechitza in a public place? And that got torn down, and there was fighting, and there was machloket. You know, and a lot of people thought, you know, if this is what happened to us in Yom Kippur, you know, something bad is coming. But all of that was gone, and weeks later, you had billboards in Tel Aviv with Shema Yisrael on it. No, nobody was upset about that. Nobody was complaining. You know, you think, where did that come from? You had these images of restaurants in Tel Aviv, non-kosher restaurants, kashering their kitchens so that they could donate food to the chayalim, donate food to the soldiers. It was unbelievable. We couldn't have made this up. And the buses, every bus you walk in the street, you know, it says Beyachad Nenatzeach on the front of the bus. The eggs, you buy eggs in the supermarket. It sounds silly, but you buy eggs in the supermarket and the stamp on the egg that gives you the date of manufacture says Beyachad Nenatzeach. The eggs say that. The water meant that. The toilet paper says Beyachad Nenatzeach. Only in Israel. And I think to a certain extent that the what people talk about now, you know, there is a narrative that there was unity and the unity has gone back and we've gone back to October 6th. I don't think that's correct. I think it's very, very important to explain that is not correct. There is a fringe. And there always has been, there always will be a fringe that thinks differently. You have extreme views in every society. The difference between then and now is this, that before, on October 6th, that fringe was bringing the mainstream along with them. And today, the mainstream is not there. The majority of the people in Israel, again, from across the divide, right, left, religious, secular, doesn't matter, the majority of people are not there. In terms of division, in terms of this, you know, machanaut, they say in Hebrew, where, you know, everybody's in different camps and different parties. unfortunately, sometimes comes from the top. Sometimes you have the leaders, and sometimes you have the media, and sometimes that are pushing this view. But it's really not there. Let me share with you just a short idea, something I spoke about on Shabbat. You mentioned Parashat Chukat, but it's Sunday, so I can still talk about Parashat Korach. You know, we read this parasha. Another thing which for me has stood out very strongly is that since October 7th, every parasha, you know, every chapter of Tanakh, of Chumash and of Navi has, you know, reads very, very differently. It just resonates in such a deep way. And you read Korach and you think, you know, is this what's happening today? You know, you have these protests and you have this division and you have, you know, the challenging the leaders. Let me be clear. I'm not comparing anybody today to Korach and I'm not comparing anybody today to Moshe Rabbeinu. But you think, you know, should we just raise our hands and just, you know, give up? We're just a people that is fractious. We're just all the time fighting with one another. We can never get along. It's always been that way. I mean, they challenge Moshe Rabbeinu's authority, for goodness sake. You know, that's, does any rabbi have a hope? Does any leader of the Jewish people have a hope? And it's true, Korach is all about machloket. But there is another side to the story. Because if you think about it, you have Korach, you have 250 men, right, that are killed, and you have another 14,700 in the plague. That's it. That's the division, and those people are gone. What happens as the parasha goes on, you have the story where all the Nisiyim, where all the heads of the Shvatim bring their stick into the Ohel Moed to see who is going to be the tribe which is chosen by Hashem. And there's a miracle which is performed that the staff of Aaron begins to blossom. It has flowers, almonds on it, right? And all the other sticks stay the same. And that way, that is the miracle. Everybody knows that Hashem has chosen the tribe of Levi to be the Levi. Then the Chumash tells us that all the other heads of the tribes took their stick home. So Zalman Tsarovsky, in his name, the Torah, asks a beautiful, insightful question. He says, what were they taking those sticks home for? You have this dry piece of, the staff of Aaron, I understand. It has flowers, it's a miracle, it's a sign, it's a remembrance of the miracle which Hashem did. All the others, you're going home, you're taking the souvenir and saying, hey, we lost. Hashem didn't choose us. And you're going to hang up the stick and show it to everyone. What's the point? So Rav Sorotkin says the following. He says, you know what those sticks were? And he calls them. He says, that stick, that staff of every nation was the gedulato v'gavato shel oto shevet. It was the greatness and it was the pride of the shevet. Why? Because let's think about what was the competition between them. The competition between them was who's going to be the tribe of Levi, so to speak. Meaning who's going to give up their portion in the land, who's going to give up their inheritance, who's going to give up economic independence, who's going to be dependent on others for food, for everything. Why? Why are you giving everything up, all your material blessing that you could have? Because you want to serve. Because you want to be the ones that are Mesharet B'Kodesh, the ones that are giving over and dedicating their lives for Hashem and dedicating their lives for Klal Yisrael. Every single Shevet wanted to do that. So they come home with the stick, and it doesn't matter that they were chosen or weren't chosen in the end. In fact, that's what they were willing to do, and that's what they were willing to give up. And that's who the Jewish people are. Jewish people are not Korach v'Adato. Jewish people are every Shevet v'Shevet. And this is what we've seen. Everybody wants to know, what can they do? How can they help? Those that can go, that can volunteer in the army. I spoke to a friend this week. He was in the army 17 years ago, and he was exempt from Miluim. For 17 years, he hasn't put on a uniform. He said on October 8th, he's got a wife and four kids at home. He said, it can't be that everybody's going out, and I'm just going to sit at home and do nothing. So he spent 10 days making phone calls in the army. Anybody, if you think you've ever experienced bureaucracy, the army is the world champion of bureaucracy, even in times of war. And he went and he spent 10 days phoning from unit to unit till he found a place where he could go and where he could help. And then he's been on Miluim for 8 months since. Didn't have to go. The number of stories of soldiers who are fighting on the front lines, tragically, who've been killed, who didn't have to go, who fought their way in to be able to go back and fight. It's unbelievable. And everybody, like I said at the beginning, everybody, the question in everybody's mind is, what can we do? How can we help? You know, we are all in this, we're part of this together. So the media would have you believe a certain narrative. But I think it's really, really important that we understand that's not where the majority of the Jewish people are, and that's not who we are.
Tell us a little bit now, what's the situation now 9 months down the line? Obviously we're all desperately praying for the return of the remaining hostages. We have adopted two hostages we've done for all the hostages, but particularly two to make it really resonate for all of us as well. We've had a lot of guest speakers coming regularly on Shabbat, connected with the war, connected with survivors and unfortunately relatives of victims and hostages as well. But could you just give us a little bit of an insight? What's the feeling now and looking forward and where's the country up to at the moment?
It's So I think everything I've said, notwithstanding, I think there's a lot of confusion at the moment. We're not really sure where things are going and what's coming next. We've been in war for 9 months. As you said, the hostages are still there, and that's top of everybody's mind. There's now what's going on in the north with Hezbollah, and everybody's kind of waiting. It's not a question of if there's going to be a war, a full-scale war in the north. It's a question of when there's going to be a full-scale war in the north. This is the thing that people have. And again, it could be tomorrow, it could be weeks, it could be months, it could be years. We're in this for the long game. War in the north may not break out for the next 3-4 years. But it's going to happen. I think everybody, that's kind of the feeling, the sense that everybody has. But we are strong. There's something that Rev. Rimon said at the funeral of Daniel Peretz, which resonated very, very deeply with me. Daniel Peretz, those who probably heard, the son of Rav Doron Peretz, who is the head of World Mizrahi. Initially, he was assumed to have been missing. They thought that he'd been taken hostage. It was later discovered that he had been killed on October 7th, and his body was taken captive. They just had some of his blood, what they were able to recover. And that's why when they held the funeral for him, they buried his blood.
So they haven't actually retrieved his body.
They have not retrieved his body, no. So he has a kever on Har Herzl, and hoping that when they're able to get his body back, bring him to a Kfarat Yisrael. Rav Rimon said something at the funeral, which he said, never before in history, and again, we say this every time, with the caveat, with all the pain and with all the grief, I'm not for a second dismissing, any of that. He said, never before in Jewish history has there been a pogrom where the Jewish people got up and fought back. The fact that what has happened, why is it, it's shocked us so much, because we're living in an age where, we haven't seen scenes like this, thank God for the last 75 years or so. But it's not unusual in Jewish history. It's tragically, it's been a part of who we are, and it's been a part of, been a part of our lives since going back all the way back to Egypt. But the fact that our enemies have come up and have risen up against us, that's something that's always happened. But the fact that we're able to get up and we're able to fight back, the fact that we have an army that we're able to defend ourselves, the fact that after the pogrom, the Jewish people got up and said, Jewish blood is not cheap, and Jewish blood is not hefka, and we will continue, we will defend ourselves, and we'll fight back. And he said, Daniel didn't die as somebody in Auschwitz or in Bergen-Belsen, but he died wearing the clothes, wearing the uniform of Tzfar Ganal Yisrael. He was wearing the Bigdei Kuna. That is something that Rav Rimon said. And again, that message resonates so, so deeply. And I think it's so important to continue to remind ourselves of that as we go through, for however long this is going to carry on for. We are not in 1948. We're not in 1973. And we're definitely not in the days of the Holocaust. People said there were a lot of comparisons that were made, the shock, the scale of this. And very early on, the president, Yitzhak Herzog made the point. He said, October 7th was the day when the most number of Jews were killed in one day since the Holocaust. And that is true. But at the same time, we're nowhere near the scale of what was back then. And we need to remember, we try and zoom out and look at the broader picture. We're not in times of Jewish history when we're just completely helpless. We're not there. We're on the path to redemption. And on the path to redemption, there are ups and there are downs. And this is a very, very big down. And there is a lot of darkness. But we will get through that. We'll get through that darkness. And there is a lot of light that is waiting around the corner. Throughout our history, every time that there has been a tremendous period of darkness in Jewish history has been followed by a certain light. Every destruction has been followed by a certain redemption. Going back all the way to Egypt, when we had the plague of darkness, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky makes the point. He says that, the Midrash tells us that during Makat Choshech, 4/5 of the Jewish people died. Those that didn't make it out of Egypt. Whether we take those numbers literally or figuratively, whatever, there's a message that Chazal are trying to tell us. And what do you think it was like to be a Jew living through those plagues? What do you think it was like to be one of Bnei Israel living through the Makah of Choshech and seeing, I don't understand, we've been sitting here in slavery for centuries. Kadosh Baruch Hu has done all these miracles to get us out, and now he's brought this plague of our neighbors are dying, our friends are dying, and everything, he's deserted us. And then a few days later, they came out. So again, it's not, there are things that we can't see, there are things we can't understand. There is tremendous, tremendous darkness. There's tremendous pain and grief and mourning and loss, and we need to acknowledge that. We need to be sensitive to that. And all of us are feeling it to one extent or another. But at the same time, we have to broaden our perspective. We have to look up, and we have to know that what's, where we are and what is coming.
So before I open up to questions on the floor, I guess there's a sentiment here as well that us in the diaspora, we're kind of watching this from the sides, but we're also at the front and center stage as well. There's been not comparable to what everyone's been experiencing in Eretz Yisrael, but we've seen a terrible rise in anti-Semitism, both on campus, within community. We've just had a new Labour government elected, which gives a lot of people anxiety and stress and concern. And I guess really, perhaps, maybe share with us, Rabbi Kenzberg, what's your perspective? What can we be doing? What should we be doing to support, to help, and to really be there for our brothers and sisters in Eretz Yisrael at this time?
So, I think the first thing I would say is tefillah. I think that's the first thing, and that's we have to know and we have to believe and we have to remember that tefillah really has an impact. You know, heartfelt tefillah. We'll talk about the parasha for a moment again. You know, in Korach, there's something very interesting that Moshe Rabbeinu, after you have this whole incident with Korach and his machloket, we find the words is al tefen el minchatam. Moshe Rabbeinu davens to Hashem. He says, don't listen to them. Don't accept their prayers. You think you're talking about Korach. You're talking about these Balei Machloket. You're talking about the people who have the audacity, who have the chutzpah to challenge Moshe Rabbeinu. If there's anybody who God's not going to listen to their prayers, it's them. And why does Moshe Rabbeinu have to say, you know, don't accept their prayers? We learn from here the power of sincere, genuine, heartfelt prayer. Even when it comes from the wrong place. Even when it comes from the wrong things. All the more so, talking about the needs of Klal Yisrael. We're talking about the hostages. Talking about Achenu Beit Yisrael. We're talking about the soldiers. We're talking about those who are wounded. We're talking about the Mufunim, the evacuees in the north and the south. Everybody. Our prayer has power, and we should remember that, and we shouldn't neglect it. And it's difficult, you know, as time goes on. We've had this problem as well in our shul. We have the two Pirkei Tehillim every day. At a certain point, it starts to become rote. So what do? So maybe you change the perek. Maybe instead of saying it responsibly, everybody says it together. Maybe you sing it. Do whatever. We can find ways. But I think prayer, number one, tefillah, that is something which is very, very important, something we all have to do. Beyond that, what can we do tangibly? So I think that visits to Israel are super important at this time. I think both, you know, just in terms of the message that it sends, and in terms of for everybody, you know, who goes, you'll come back, you won't be the same. You know, you will be changed, you will be touched, and you will think about things differently, and you'll ask yourself the question, what more can I do? But it sends such a message to us in Israel as well, to know that everybody in the diaspora is with us and is thinking about us and, you know, that support. I told people at the beginning of the war, people were asking me, you know, what can we do to help from afar? I said, pick up the phone and call your friends in Israel. Just pick up the phone and say, just thinking about you, want to know, you know, how you're doing. Not necessarily those that are soldiers or those who have children that are soldiers or those who've been affected because they've left their homes or people that are injured, obviously. But just anybody, everybody's going through a certain amount of anxiety. Everybody's going through this fear. Everybody's going through something. Just to know that we're all one people. We're all in it together. That means so, so, so much. So I think that's another thing that we can do. In terms of, you know, tangibly, materially as well. So there are a lot of places where people can donate in terms of, you know, giving, helping with supplies and helping with food and helping with money. That's something that's very, very useful. And I'll just mention on this point, we've opened up, as mentioned at the beginning, in addition to the shul, I also work in a place called Eretz Chemda. Eretz Chemda is a kollel in Yerushalayim. It's where I study. We have a program called Manigut Toranit, which is where I studied for 6 years before I came on Shlichut, came to London. And it's a very unique program where basically all the Avrechim are people who have already got Smicha. They've already been learning Yeshivot for many years. They're learning for another 5 or 6 years to take it to the next level, to go out to be Rabbanim and some to be Dayanim and to be in different communities. One of the things that's unique about Eretz Chemda is that every Avrech who gets accepted into the Kollel to learn, if they were born in Israel, so a Tnai Saf, a condition for them to be a member, is that they served in the IDF. You know, you hear a lot these days, there's talk about, you know, Chok HaGiyus, and, you know, can Torah scholars learn in the IDF, or serve, or should they have to serve, whatever. I'm not going to get into that issue, I'm not going to get into the political issue again, I'm not here to talk about anybody else, or anybody else's ideology. But I'll talk about ours, I'm talking about what we believe in. And we believe in Safra V'Saifa, which is the book and the sword, which is, there are different ways that we can help Klal Yisrael, and everybody's required, and it's a Milchemet Mitzvah. Milchemet Mitzvah, everybody goes out to fight. So we don't see a contradiction between somebody sitting and learning with Torah and contributing to Am Yisrael in that way, in terms of learning and teaching and becoming Talmidei Chachamim, and a time comes when one has to close the Gemara, when one has to go out, when one has to fight. So I've been, I help with this program, and I work there. This is Rabbi Doron Podlashuk, who is himself, he's the founder and director of the program. He was a shalech in South Africa for a number of years. And he, at the beginning of the war also, he was one of those people, he was a combat soldier. He said, can't be, everybody else is going out to fight, I'm not going to go. So he also, he spent a number of weeks making phone calls, and eventually he was given a shibutz, and he's been in Miluim for 6 months. Most of our Avrechim, you know, you walk into the Beit Midrash and Eretz Chemda for the better part of 9 months, and it's been empty. A handful of people there, because everybody that we've had guys fighting on the north, fighting in the south, in Yehuda v'Shomron, people have been called up 3-4 times. You know, they come back from Miluim, they're back for a week, and then they get called up again. Now with the north, what's going to happen? So, and every time that happens, you have soldiers that are out in Miluim, you have families that are left behind, you have wives that are left behind with the children by themselves, and you know, you need babysitters, you need to make food, you need to make all sorts of things. So one of the things that we've done, again, everybody's looking for ways to help and to assist in the soldiers. At the beginning, there were all these drives for food. You know, in many places, people donating. People like to donate what they want to donate, not necessarily what is needed. And unfortunately, there's a lot of waste that goes, you know, Bisley and Bamba, the amount of Bisley and Bamba that came to our ILM. But when sometimes they need other things as well. So what we've done is at Eretz Chemda, we've actually opened up a special fund, what we've called the Safra Vasaifa Miluim Fund. And we're giving people the opportunity as well, those who want to contribute and those who want to help in this way. As I said, there are many different ways you can help. Tefillah is important, visiting is important, phone calls are important, writing letters are important. Those who feel that this is a way they can contribute as well. So this is something that I've got flyers here as well, which I'll leave at the end. If people feel that they want to, I want to empower you to give in this way if you feel that you can. And what we're asking essentially is for, we've set it up in a way that a person can, one can adopt a certain chayal avrech for 1,000 shekels a month. Obviously, people want to give less, people want to give more, whatever. That is also, but that's another way. And there are many different organizations. I mentioned Rav Rimon's organization before. Many different ways and different channels which we can fund in that way. So I think, you know, the spiritual help, the tangible help, you know, the material help, and to continue asking ourselves those questions. And we're all in it together. What can we do, and how can we contribute to one another? At this point, I want to turn around to you. And I want to ask you, you know, we've been talking about what it's been like for us, but what's it been like for you? What's it been like post October 7th to be a Jew in Chutz Laaretz? I know it's not been, again, we just see things on the news. I have to say that it looks very, very scary. I can tell you last night when I was packing my bags to come here. So first of all, you know, it's 36 degrees Celsius in Israel. I nearly didn't bring a coat at all. I'm glad I did. But, it's okay. You know, I have a jumper, this project that we did together with Rav Rimon. What's called Atufim. So when we visited this community of Tzocha, so they made jumpers. You know, they're joining with other communities from America and from England and other places. So, you know, the Americans like to have, you know, the swag. And so I have a jumper at home. It says on the front, it says Atufim, and on the back it has a map of Israel and a blue heart inside. So I took the jumper. I took this out of the cupboard. And again, I may be overreacting because I'm an Israeli who's been watching the news. But I took this jumper out, and Sarah had a look, and she said, maybe it's better you don't take that to, you know. Maybe it's better that we don't walk around with, you know, visible signs of Jewishness, of Israel, etc. So let me ask you, number one, is that an overreaction? You know, and what's it been like over here? And what can we do to help you?
Oh, wow. Interesting. Okay. So I guess I'd be very interested to hear people's thoughts. My personal thoughts are that I think it looks from a distance much more scary than it is in reality. I know the family, we did an outing over Hanukkah. We went to Kidzania. And I was a little bit nervous. We're going to West London. We're leaving Golders Green Hens, and I was putting baseball caps on the children and, you know, wrapping them up. And Nina said, do me a favor, make sure they're wearing their kippot. You know, we're proud Jews living in London. We're going to go there proudly. I said, you know, Dino, it's not such a great part of London. But I said, fine, we'll do it. And they were wearing their kippot. And this Israeli man came over to me in Kidzania and said, you've given me such chizuk to see that you can wear your kippot proudly. Now, whether I'd recommend other people do that, I don't know. Everyone needs to make decisions for themselves. But there is certainly a sense of a terrible rise in anti-Semitism, and a lot of people who perhaps were on the fringes and it was a little bit quiet behind the scenes, they feel kind of mobilized to verbally express that. And that's been really sad to see, both on campus, within communities, and unfortunately we've seen a rise in it. But I think also, you know, it's been a reminder to all of us that we live in the diaspora. You know, the Jewish people have been traveling throughout Jewish history from place to place to place. We should never get too comfortable, because ultimately we're all supposed to be in Eretz Yisrael. That's where we're all headed. I mean, it's Hashem. But I think in terms of how it's been, I'd be interested to hear if anyone has any other thoughts. It has been a challenging time for sure. very, very difficult. A lot of us have family and friends in Israel who we're constantly worrying about. And a lot of us have, I found it particularly, I mean, I work in a very Jewish environment, in a Jewish school. But even so, with non-Jewish colleagues who perhaps they get their main source of the information from the BBC and other news outlets, to express to them and to articulate to them what we're feeling and what's going on has been incredibly challenging. And I don't know if we've always been able to do that. That's been very hard. I know I've spoken to members of our shul who are in, you know, secular work environments. That's been really, really tough. And perhaps people are less comfortable being openly Jewish in those settings. Mm-hmm. But if anyone has any other experiences they wish to add.
Sorry, actually, you just remind me of something I just want to add as well, because you mentioned the BBC. Now, if it's on the BBC, it must be true, right? That there's another realm to this war as well, which is the, you know, the PR war, you know, the Hasbara. The truth is, I go back and forth in my head about this, because you see some of the lies that are spread and just how disingenuous it is. And sometimes, you know, I wonder to myself, you know, is there even any point? Is there even any point trying to fight the narrative when it's so clear how biased and skewed it is against us? But at the same time, you know, we have to try. But I think that everybody has, right now, you know, certainly every Jew that's living in Chutz La'aretz is a spokesman for the Jewish people. I had a call a number of months ago with some of the Rabbanim in Chutz La'aretz, and I made this point. I said, you know, you may not be used to seeing yourself this way, and it may be not, it's not the typical, you know, job description of the rabbi, you know, to be the official spokesman. Yeah, not for the government, but for the Jewish people. And I think we're all spokesmen. And today, you know, everybody has access to a keyboard. Everybody has access to social media, you know, to write letters, to make phone calls, whatever it is. I think this is something that's really, really important. Everybody to whatever level they're able to do that. But because a lot of people, look, the anti-Semites out there, you're never going to convince. But a lot of people are just ignorant. A lot of people just don't know. You know, think about how we think about, you know, the conflict in Russia and Ukraine. Now, if I was to ask you here about the details and how many people have died and what's happened, and that, most people, I assume, probably wouldn't know. If I was to ask you about what's going on, you know, with the Uyghur Muslims in China, again, I thought you'll know because we made a campaign about it, we're aware, but most people just have no idea. And that's how most people, you know, think about Israel, something, okay, so, you know, there's Israelis, there's Palestinians, there's tremendous ignorance out there. People don't know what happened on October 7th. People don't know that Israel is the most moral army in the world and the lengths that we go to endanger our own soldiers in order to protect enemy civilians. People just don't know. And it's something that we need to try. We need to raise our voices. We need to try and make our voices heard as much as we can. Obviously, there's a limit to what we can do. But I think everybody, you know, where they are, that's definitely another area that we can focus on.
It's particularly worrying for younger people as well. You know, the younger children, teenagers are all on social media. I think the statistic is on TikTok, you're 28 times more likely to see an anti-Israel post than a pro-Israel post.
Yeah.
And this has a huge effect.
It's got an algorithm there.
There is a sure algorithm.
China's put that out.
And that's frightening. And that's frightening for our young people, whereas 10, 20, 30 years ago would grow up, even in the more traditional Jewish world, would always be pro-Israel, would always want to be going on Israel tour, would always want to have that affiliation. Unfortunately, that affiliation has definitely been diluted. And that's a big concern and a big worry, and I think that has to be a major focus of our efforts as well. I think at this point, first of all, I want to just thank you. This has been an incredible insight for all of us, and it really brings everything so much closer to home to all of us. And we thank you, we applaud you, we wish you and your family hatzlacha. And I think actually the idea of a Magen Avot mission to Israel, I think, is an amazing idea. And I think this should come out from this evening. This would be something we should definitely be talking about in the council and exploring whether we do it ourselves. We partner with other communities. I think it would be an incredible thing for us to come and to visit with you firsthand, to come to Hanasi and to visit you there. But I think at this point, I'd like to just open to the floor for anyone who has any other questions. So I can invite Nash for your opportunity to ask questions.
So you mentioned, you know, the life of the nation is pre or post October 7th, putting aside the military lessons and how it even came to happen in the first place. What lessons do you think people have learned?
You know, I think until October 7th, meaning we've always known that we have to fight for our lives in Israel. Throughout our history, there's been terror attacks, there's been wars, there's been operations, there's been rockets, there's been Tiftufim that we spoke about. I don't think anybody, you know, recognized the magnitude of the threat. You know, everybody knows that in 1948, you know, there was an existential threat to the state of Israel. 1967, there was an existential threat, and, you know, we felt it. We thought that we were past that. We thought that, you know, there was a time when there was, you know, we have problems here and there, but Sahel is strong, you know, the nation is strong, you know, we never thought that we'd be fighting for our lives, literally, the way that we are now. And I think that's something that's really sunk in, and that is back in everyone's consciousness. And that is going to have, again, how this plays out, you know, these are processes which take a long time. And how that plays out in terms of the makeup of the army and who goes in and how, you know, for many, many years, you know, I don't want to get into politics, I don't want to get into military strategy either. It's not my area of expertise. It's anyone's area of expertise at the moment, which is one of our problems. But you know, they've been talking for many years about this idea of the tzava katan v'chacham. You know, a smaller army based more on technology, you know, the era of, you know, big wars and foot soldiers and everything was over, and, you know, we have fences and we have drones and we have missiles and we have things, and we don't need as many soldiers fighting. I think that's all, you know, that's an illusion that's come crashing down, unfortunately. And again, I think that we've all learned that we are far more resilient than we realized, and that we are far more united than we ever realized and that we thought. And that is, you know, the weeks, the days following October 7th, you know, a lot of the divisions were completely erased. And you talk about, you know, left and right wing in Israel. You know, the weeks after October 7th, there was no such thing as left and right wing in Israel. You know, everybody was, now it's sort of starting to come back and starting to creep in terms of that. And obviously, we're Jews, we have different opinions, and people are going to think differently about things. But I you know, the conversation, I think, in Israel certainly has moved. You know, and this is maybe something you don't see as much, being in Chutz La'aretz and seeing things through the media, which still has a certain agenda. You know, I'll just mention, for example, again, I'm not going to get into politics now, and that's not, but, you know, people talk about, I hear statements coming out from the UK and from your government, yeah, you know, talking about the two-state solution, and you just have to understand that right now, you know, for the majority of the Israeli public, you know, you may as well be talking about Mars. You know, two-state solution is not something that is on anybody's mind. It's not something that people are talking about. Maybe, you know, maybe when one day in 30 years' time, it's be something that we can talk about. But remember that a lot of the places that were attacked on October 7th, these were, you know, peace-loving kibbutzim. These were, the, you know, the left of the left. You had people who were, you know, had all sorts of schemes of coexistence. You know, a lot of people who were, you know, volunteering with Arabs and helping them with certain things. And some of the people who were, you know, from Gaza, who were working in the kibbutzim, were actually gathering intelligence about who they could kill and how they could do it. So even those in the political spectrum who had that trust or had that hope kind of on the other side that we can negotiate and we can work towards something, you know, that was shattered in the most violent way possible. So again, I'm not expressing a political opinion. I'm not getting into it right now. You know, is it something that maybe we will want to and be able to work towards one day? Maybe. But just right now, it's just so... It's just so foreign to the conversation. And, you know, for somebody in Israel to hear about, you know, somebody in Chutz, you know, come and start, you know, talking about, you know, two-state solution, for example, you know, it's just kind of, where's this coming from? So that's something as well.
How do you see the younger generation, the children, your children, long-term being affected by this?
So, you know, one of the things you hear a lot and people talk about in Israel, that's, you know, we thought this, they used to call this generation the Dora TikTok. That's what they said, you know, which in English is the TikTok generation. You know, people thought, you know, we have the stories of 1948 and of 1967 and stories about Jewish history and people getting up and people fighting and people, you know, people think nowadays, you know, the youth nowadays are selfish and they, you know, all they care about is their screens, whatever. And we've seen the way that people have, you know, most of the soldiers, okay, you have the reservists who are older, but the soldiers, you know, 18, 19, 20 years old, you know, we're talking about kids. We're talking about this generation. They don't call it the TikTok generation anymore. They talk about Dora Nitzachon, you know, the generation of victory. And we've seen the commitment, we've seen the fire, you know, something which has come out. I think we called this evening, we called it a nation of heroes. You know, there are a lot of heroes in the Jewish people in many, many different areas and many different realms. And one of the things that's come out is a lot of the soldiers have written letters. You know, at the beginning, it just happened a few, you know, some did, and they were actually encouraged at a certain point that the soldiers are going up, and some of them aren't going to come back. And they write letters, and they write messages which they leave for their families. You read the things, you know, you read the words. I encourage everybody afterwards to go and, you know, look it up. And you think, you know, where do these people come from? How do they have, you know, the strength, the resilience, the perspective, and putting the cloud, putting the, you know, putting everything else above themselves, and just, it's just been quite incredible. So I think, you know, in terms of look, in terms of the the younger kids, and I think what my kids been through, they had Corona, then they had the war, and then it's been a really abnormal situation the last few years. But our people are strong and resilient, and there's a dedication and there's a devotion to a greater cause. You know, we thought that people maybe are not devoted to ideals the way they were once upon a time. You know, this has come and it's shown that they're much stronger. And I think those values are really that's what's seeping in, and that's what the kids are getting.
You mentioned the parsha that yesterday, how many thousands of people were killed under our Korach.
Yeah.
Out of the whole of Klal Yisrael. It was an enormous number. And yet, you read it, and we're on to the next parsha. And yet now, we're counting with the news feeds, which everyone has on their phones. Each time one of the Chayalim is killed, it's a big problem. I mean, we feel it. And yet the 17,000 in the parsha yesterday, not at all. So the modern technology brings us into the modern world, and we see things differently nowadays. Each person is a karban.
You know, I think this is something which is a very, very poignant time of year in Israel. You know, the week where we go from Yom HaShoah to Yom HaZikaron and Yom HaTzmaut. So it stood out very, very strongly for me, you know, the contrast between Yom HaShoah and Yom HaZikaron. And if you go to the ceremonies and you listen to the speeches and things that are made, you know, Yom HaShoah has been, for many years, it's been all about numbers. You know, 6 million. 6 million is a number that is just so big, you know, we cannot fathom it. And one of the things that the Nazis tried to do to us, they tried to dehumanize us. You know, to the extent you weren't a name, you were just literally, you were a number that was tattooed on your arm. You weren't a name, you weren't a person, you weren't an individual. And in recent years, you have the Yellow Candle Project, in different ways, Yad Vashem, they're involved in bringing back the names, bringing back the stories of the individuals, because that's what they tried to wipe out, that's what we tried to recreate. And you contrast that with Yom HaZikaron, which comes a week later, and again, we have the numbers, but it's all about names, and it's all about the personal stories, all about the individuals. You go to any Yom HaZikaron ceremony in Israel, one feature of that ceremony will be reading out names. The names of the soldiers from that town, from that yeshuv, or from that unit, or from that place, who've been killed. So yes, because that's who we are, the Jewish people. Every individual is an olam umlaa. Right? We know the Mishnah in Sanhedrin talks about, you know, you save one Jewish life, you've saved the entire world. So again, and there is a delicate, with the media and with all that comes along, there is a delicate balancing act here. It's about giving remembrance and giving credit and paying tribute and paying homage to each and every individual. But with all that, you know, we have to be careful. We have to be careful that it should not cause us to despair and cause us to say, sometimes you hear people saying, oh, the price is too high, you know, we have to stop. Well, no, because the price is incredibly high. The price is higher than any of us would want to pay. And I'm sitting here as somebody who's lost a brother, I know what the price is. But we also know that if, you know, to stop now, then it's just a matter of time. Be it another 2 years, another 3 years, another 10 years, whatever, we'll just have to do all of this over again.
Without getting into politics, I mean, you mentioned that there were divisions, and unfortunately, we see the divisions sort of rising again.
Right.
And there is a major issue that was that came about now with Chok HaGiyus, and there's no question that you see the. I'm not talking about the Haredi, but people like you and probably us who are practicing Jews, versus the secular people in Israel. And there is this, what I see, first of all, is that there's much more strength. I mean, the way that you speak about the whole, taking this whole 7th of October tragedy in a sort of historical perspective, and Am Yisrael Chai, and, you know, we'll continue. You have many people who don't have that that belief. The question to you is, what are you doing, if you're doing anything, with regard to creating this unity and bringing the rest of Am Yisrael, or Zachim, you know, this is those Israelis that don't have the same point of view as you, or don't have the belief as you, to, you know, for this unity. Because the unity lasted only for a while, you know, when people were facing really the...
So let, So let me tell you a story. Tell you a story which I heard from a friend of mine who is a Rav Tzfai. He's a military rabbi. And he said, you know, the following story. He said one of his chayalim, one of the soldiers in his unit, was somebody who was completely secular. He's not attached to anything. He said all of a sudden, you know, a number of months in, you know, he started to, I don't remember exactly what it was, but he said, to observe something very, very small. I think he started not observing, but marking the holidays. You know, do something, you know, notice the fact that it's Chanukah, that it's Pesach, that it's Purim. Again, he's not keeping all the halachot, you know, certainly not cleaning his house for Pesach, you know, but he started doing, you know, a person who did absolutely nothing. And he said that on Miloim, you know, when you have time off and you have breaks and people used to go and used to have arguments and discussions and, you know, have political discussions, whatever, this guy was always, you know, didn't have time for any of it. And he said, after a number of months, he came up to him and said, "Kvod HaRav, you know, I want you to know, we've decided at home we're going to celebrate Chanukah, we're going to celebrate Pesach. Again, not in a halachic way, you know, kala chamura." And he said, "Why?" He said, "I'll tell you why." He said that, you know, he was there, he was in the army, he was at the beginning, a number of weeks, number of months, whatever it was, and the soldiers there are not watching the news, and they don't see that. So he said, October 7th, you know, so he came home after a certain period of leave, And he started catching up, started watching some of the videos, started watching some of the articles, listening to the news, and he saw some of the videos of October 7th. And he saw the terrorists running around and screaming, you know, kill the Jews, kill the Jews. And he turned to his wife, and he said, "What makes us Jewish?" Yeah, it suddenly occurred to him, he said, you know, they're fighting against us because we are Jewish, you know, what is it that makes us Jew? How does it define? What can it be? He said, "It can't be that it's just, you know, in name only. It can't be that I'm Jewish because, you know, my grandparents were killed because they were Jewish. It's got to be something more than that." So he said, "We have to go and we have to do something." So he chose, you know, his wife said, "Oh, no, that you're going to come to me with Chazar B'Tshuva, whatever." He said, "No, don't worry, it'll be fine." But you hear a lot of that. And there are many, many, many stories like that. There is another, it was a number of months ago, a famous, you know, entertainer or that in Israel who said that until October 7th, I thought that I was Israeli and not Jewish. Is it an Israeli? He says, "Now I understand that we're all Jewish." And I think, you know, that sentiment is there. It's very, very aware. It's very, very strong. It's in the army. You know, you see, again, if you've seen the videos of the Chayalim, you see them singing, you see the talks at the command, completely secular commanders give up into going into battle, the way they talk to the Chayalim. There is a sense of Jewish history. There is a sense of Jewish destiny. There is a sense that, you know, we're a part of something bigger. Remember, you know what this operation is called? The massacre that took place on October 7th. You know, Hamas called it, they named it the Al-Aqsa Flood. It's named after Jerusalem. Al-Aqsa, there's Jerusalem. This is in Be'eri and Kfar Aza. They understand that's what we're fighting about. The soldiers have said, you know, the soldiers go in, "I actually wanted to bring to you," and in the end I wasn't able to get it. But one of our chayalim, one of the Avrechim who learns in Manigut Taranit, he was in Gaza for a few months, and he brought back, he said he had a map of the which he found in one of the houses. Every single house, as I've heard from a number of soldiers, every single house in Gaza has a picture of Al-Aqsa on the wall. Every single house. Every single one there understands that the center of the battle is for Jerusalem. What we call Yerushalayim HaKodesh. And what they call, like, I mean, then this is a, there is, they understand that this is a fight about identity. It's about, you know, who we are and what is the message that we bring to the world. And I think that we are starting to realize that. I think that people are, you know, certainly in the army, you see it amongst the Chayalim. Obviously, there's always more that we can do. And it's about, you know, going out and talking to people and spreading the message. I think that, again, since October 7th, people from diverse backgrounds, different places, are much more willing to listen, are much more willing to talk to one another and to realize, you know, that we have something in common, and what is it that we have in common, and how can we work together? Everybody realizes we are not just Israeli, Yehudim. I think that, again, there are always fringes. There are always people on the extremes of both sides. But by and large, most of us understand that. And it's about, you know, taking it forward, and how do we develop that consciousness.
Okay, I think we've got time for one final question. I think we could be sitting with you till midnight. I know that you've been up since 2 a.m. this morning on a flight. So
I was just going to ask how you plan, as like Rabbanim of communities, to approach this year, Simchas Torah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a great question. It's a question that every rabbi has been asking himself. The truth is that it's a question that's come up before every single chag. I can tell you, I didn't mention this at the beginning, but after October 7th happened, you know, we had, for the first few months, we had a big machloket in our shul, whether it's appropriate to do anything. Can we have a kiddush? How can you have a kiddush when soldiers are out there and they're fighting, right? And it goes back to Shreiner's question. The other side was, you know, we are a community where people here also have needs. You know, people are sitting at home by themselves. They're anxious. They're worried. You have a kiddush within the, again, we're not celebrating and dancing on the tables, right? But it's a way of people to come together. It's a way of community to come together and look out for one another. So these were the two sides. And we found a certain balance. But, you know, and I've spoken about this before every chag. I spoke about a Chanukah. I spoke about a Purim. I spoke about a Pesach. I spoke about Yom HaTzmaut. You know, there is one side to say, maybe it's not appropriate to be celebrating now, maybe we shouldn't be. There's another side to say that there's such a deeper meaning behind all of these, like, you know, you think about Purim. You know, what happened on Purim? Purim, there was a genocidal war against the Jewish people and we emerged victorious. That's what Purim is. Pesach's the same thing. Yom HaTzmaut. Yom HaTzmaut, you know, we talk about the war that happened. We talk about the spirit of bravery that, I could go on for hours, I'm not going to, one of the central messages of Yom HaTzmaut, you know, why is it on that day? And hey, B.E.R., the day the state was declared, maybe it would have made more sense to celebrate it on the day that we signed the ceasefire agreement, right? The day that the war ended. Yom HaTzmaut, the war in that phase only began. And part of the reason we say is because there was a certain spirit of bravery that was instilled in the leaders of our nation to be able to stand up, to be able to declare the state. That was something, that spirit of bravery, that's what we celebrate today. So I think all of these things, it's about looking into the chag and looking into it and understanding how it resonates within our current reality and how we connect to that. I'll just mention as well, I'm in a lot of trouble, but I haven't actually said anything about the baby throughout the whole talk. So 3 months ago, we had a baby, Baruch Hashem. And, thank you. And we named him Amichai. You know, that's a name that had this whole, had we not been in this period, I don't think it's a name we would have even thought of. But it's a name which is very, very, very meaningful to us. There are a lot of Amichais that have been born in Israel the last 9 months. Amichai, obviously, you know, they tried to destroy us, and we are here, and we will prevail. We continue to live. And that is our victory against those who glorify death, is the fact that we celebrate life. And, you know, and I said in shul that so many people, after the baby was born, you know, the most common thing I heard was, you know, Mazel Tov, and Mazel Tov now especially. It's so nice to have a simcha, especially in this time. You know, and everybody's feeling that. So we come to answer a question, or rather I haven't answered yet. Simchat Torah is going to be challenging. It's going to be difficult. Again, it's the first Yahrzeit for many. I think that, you know, there's no question. You know, will it ever be the same? I don't know. In the same way that, you know, Yom Kippur, since the Yom Kippur War, has had something different about it. Lag BaOmer, since what happened in Maron, has been different as well. Simchat Torah will be different. It won't be the same. I think part of the thing is, you know, part of it is that we have to celebrate. We have to celebrate, you know, because that's what our enemies tried to take away from us. But I don't know if you know about the Simchat Torah project which is a beautiful initiative and is a beautiful way of, you know, channeling those emotions in a different way, you know, in these challenging circumstances. And that is a way of all of Am Yisrael really coming together, of what us remembering, you know, the sadness and the joy together. This is something which, you know, part of Jewish life, and it's always been part of Jewish life, is having this mix of emotions. There is a beautiful piyut which the Sfaradim say on Rosh Hashanah. They don't have Unatana Tokev, but they have this. And it's a piyut which talks about Sharei Eit Ratzon, talks about the Akedah, and it talks about Avraham Avinu going to sacrifice his son, Yitzhak. And there's a sentence in there that says, Ayin b'mar bocheh v'lev sameach. That the eye cries bitterly with tears, and at the same time the heart is glad. Discussing, you know, the emotions of Avraham Avinu, we think about that idea that Akedah, you know, going to have to sacrifice his son. Obviously, this was the most painful, most difficult thing he ever had to do. And we know how it ended. But at the time, he didn't. So there is that sadness, that unbelievable grief. And at the same time, there is a Lev Samech, there is a gladness in terms of following Hashem, in terms of following the mitzvot, in terms of understanding who he is and what he's a part of. You know, and both of those emotions live together in this almost impossible juxtaposition. That's who we are. That's the way it's always been, and that's the way that will continue. So, I think that's one way, maybe of channeling those conflicting ideas.
Absolutely, I think Rosh Hashanah, when we open the Aron HaKodesh, we have that Sefer Torah covered in the beautiful new new mantle from Mizrahi, there won't be a dry house eye in the room, and we'll all be crying. But we'll be crying tears of joy as well. There's a beautiful book written by Sherry Mandel, The Blessing of a Broken Heart. Sherry Mandel's 12-year-old son, Kobe, was killed in 2001. Terrible tragedy. At the time, she wrote this book, The Blessing of a Broken Heart. And she describes how, you know, it's like a spring. The harder you pull it back, the further it will be released and jump forward. And when your lows are so low, your highs become so high. And I think that will be the sentiment that we will celebrate stronger than ever, with more emotion than ever, and never taken for granted, because it was by no coincidence that day was chosen. That was the day that was designated as this terrible tragedy took place. Once again, I'd like to say a huge thanks, not only to Zacharias, but to Laura Kennesberg. This has been an unbelievable congratulations. And, we wish you hatzlacha on all that you're doing, and we look forward to supporting you and coming to visit you, and, Yes, Hashem, we should have only good news for sort of the whole of Klal Yisrael. And thanks again for everyone for coming.
Amen. I look forward to you all coming to visit. Everybody's welcome and invited. And thank you all. It's been wonderful to be here. I'll be back in again, Avod. And really, really enjoyed being here and speaking to you. We're going to leave some flyers behind as well, if anybody wants more information about Manikut Torahnit and what we discussed earlier. So, QR code, and it's all very, very easy.